If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, February the 27th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Our guests plural today here in our recording studio on the campus of Stanford University are David Brady and Doug Rivers. Dave Brady is the Bowen H. and Janice Arthur McCoy Professor of Political Science in the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and he's a Senior Fellow Emeritus at the Hoover Institution. Doug Rivers is a Hoover Institution Senior Fellow and a Stanford University Political Scientist. He's also the Chief Scientist at YouGov PLC, a global polling firm. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It's been exactly 1 month since we last convened here to talk about the state of the race. That was before Iowa and whatever happened in Iowa that night, which we may never know. That was before the primary results in New Hampshire, before the caucusing results in Nevada. And we sit here now a couple of days away from South Carolina. And a few days after that, the big enchilada, which is Super Tuesday. Let's start this off with a very large general question. What have we learned that we didn't know a month ago about this race?
Well, so far, the Democratic primaries have been a disaster for the Biden campaign. And Bernie Sanders, who 6 months ago looked like he was on his last legs, is the clear front runner among Democrats. Mm-hmm. That's based on a very small number of voters. The caucuses in Iowa and Nevada had fewer voters in a single congressional district. Mm-hmm. Sanders, at least in New Hampshire and Iowa, actually underperformed what he did 4 years ago. But he's jumped out to a reasonably significant lead nationally among Democrats. So about 30% of Democrats, he's their first choice ahead of Biden, Warren, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, and far ahead of Bloomberg.
Right. Clarified disaster for Biden because he could, we don't know what's going to actually happen in South Carolina, right, but some polls indicate he will win on Saturday.
Yeah.
Which has been their strategy all along.
Right. So a decisive win in South Carolina, I think, would resuscitate the Biden campaign and make him the alternative to Sanders. Mm-hmm. I think he is going to win in South Carolina. The latest polling has been better for him. But I think Sanders will be second place in South Carolina and move into Super Tuesday, where the Biden campaign doesn't have a lot going for it at the moment. They don't have much of a national organization. They don't have money to advertise.
Right. Right. Essentially, here in California, who do you see advertising? Well, you cannot avoid Michael Bloomberg. It's hard to avoid Tom Steyer. Bernie Sanders has been advertising kind of moderately, but he's been around for a couple weeks. This morning, I saw a Buttigieg ad, so he is advertising. But in a very large field, that's it for California advertising.
Yeah, and Sanders doesn't really need advertising because
right,
he has a passionate base of people. It's not a majority, but that
right,
will come out and vote for him, whereas the other candidates do need it. Tom Steyer put a huge amount of resources into South Carolina, essentially buying support from Democratic state legislators. I think South Carolina will be his last. I think he's going to perform poorly there and below expectations.
Okay. Dave Brady, we keep hearing this word in politics called electability. And you hear this especially in conversations. Joe Biden wants to talk about electability. Amy Klobuchar wants to talk about electability. Bernie Sanders does not want to talk about electability necessarily, but this comes up every time that the prospect is raised of him being the nominee. What has February's results told us about electability in the Democrats?
Well, Biden's electability is down. Biden campaign was on the electable candidate, and his numbers, when you ask the question in the YouGov weekly poll, when you ask the question, if Joe Biden ran against Donald Trump, who do you think would win? And this is among likely Democratic voters. Biden was always at over, he was the only candidate over 65, 68%. He's fallen to about 52%. Bloomberg, who before the debate was at 52 electable. He's at 44 now, and he's fallen from 18% of the vote in the poll to 11%. I didn't exactly lose a bet to Doug because I didn't make it, but the notion was how bad was that performance, and it was bad. The other thing I have learned about this electability is, turns out that if you break Democrats into very liberal and moderate to conservative, very liberals are about a quarter of the party. People who say they're liberal are 32-33%, and anyway, 38-40% are moderate to conservative. And there are huge differences there. Biden lost across, so if you look at where he was in October and where he is now, he lost among the very liberal 8% on the vote. He went from 18 to 10. He down 11 points among liberals and 10 points among moderate conservatives. And his electability, the only people who think he's electable now are liberals and moderates and conservatives. The very liberal think he isn't. Among Sanders supporters, the very liberal, 46% are for him, and 74% think Bernie Sanders can win among very liberals.
74%.
Among liberals, only 49% think he can win, and among moderates, only 45%. So here's Sanders, as Doug pointed out rightly, the clear leader. And yet among liberals, this is 75% of the party, they don't think that he can, not even a majority think he can win. And then when we asked, looked at the question, the generic ballot, would you vote for? It turns out moderates to conservatives don't look to me like they're going to vote for Bernie. Big numbers of them say, no, we haven't asked that question directly. I think they're going to now. But the point is, they're getting hammered. Democrats are getting hammered in two ways. The very liberals, they think they can win. And they're very, by the way, 34% of people who are very liberal and likely to vote said that they thought the Democratic Party was corrupt, and whereas liberals and moderates, much less than that. So these people are very unhappy. But on the other hand, the moderate and conservatives, which is 38-40%, they do not see Sanders as viable. And I think the Sanders people are not going to be happy if somebody else gets it.
Right.
It doesn't look good for the Democrats in that sense because they're getting hammered both ways.
Doug, pick up on Bernie and explain what is going on. Should we call it a phenomenon? How to explain how someone who, well, he's not a Democrat. He joins the Democratic Party every 4 years to run for president. He caucuses with Democrats, but he's not a rank-and-file Democratic member. He has some positions for popular Democrats, but he is, we can agree, at the extreme end of the party, if you will. How to explain what's going on here?
Yeah, so there are two pieces of evidence about what Sanders' electability is. One is asking people, do you think Sanders would beat Donald Trump, or do you think Joe Biden would beat Donald Trump? And that is one where Democrats have convinced themselves that Sanders has a good chance of beating Trump. It's interesting that Republicans have the opposite view. Over 90% of Republicans think that Trump would beat Sanders, and independents by a wide margin think Trump would beat Sanders.
I know you don't have the numbers in front of you, but if you flip this, if you ask the same question in 2016 and change the characters, would Republicans and Democrats have been saying the same thing about Donald Trump?
I looked at this in Doug's recontact, and in 2016, we got between 18 and 20% of Sanders voters in the primary ultimately did not support Hillary.
I think the answer to your question is, in 2016, you would find Republicans did not think Trump could beat the Democratic candidate.
Right. But Democrats would have been convinced that Hillary would win.
No, that's absolutely correct.
Democrats believed overwhelmingly that Clinton would win.
Yeah.
But in this who's going to win, there's a bunch of motivated reasoning. People think their candidate is the one that's going to win.
Right.
So I really view it as kind of you compare the levels of those things. The real piece of evidence, I think, has convinced people that Sanders does have a shot of winning are the trial heats. So these are where we ask, if Bernie Sanders was the Democratic nominee running against Donald Trump, who would you vote for? And right now, if you look at the numbers, Sanders beats Trump by about 5 or 6 points in most polls, about the same as Biden. And I think that's a bunch of people have convinced themselves that Sanders is competitive against Trump. And I think that's a misreading of the polls.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the reason for this is, well, first, frequently people ask the wrong question. They say, if the election were held today,
right,
and the Democratic candidate was Bernie Sanders and the Republican candidate were Donald Trump, who would you vote for? And the options are Sanders, Trump, and there are two more. One is I don't know, and the other is I would not vote. Okay, well, the first thing is the election is not being held today. Mm-hmm. So we're asking, would you not vote in a hypothetical, non-existent election? And believe it or not, a bunch of people say I would not vote. And those are disproportionately young liberal Democrats who are enthusiastic Sanders supporters. So Sanders actually Trump actually, if you ask people, gets more votes in a trial heat against Sanders than he does against the other candidate. But Sanders more than makes it up because there are a bunch of people, particularly Sanders supporters, who in this trial heat question say, I wouldn't vote or I'm undecided. And in fact, if you look, I think first, a bunch of these people, A, are not voters because right, all the polls overstate voters. But second, they're not going to have any choice if Donald Trump's a Republican candidate versus any Democrat, maybe excluding Michael Bloomberg. Interesting paper came out yesterday from David Brockman at Berkeley and Josh Kalla at Yale, which basically did the computation of what would the turnout rate have to be among younger voters to make this real. And the answer is astronomical. So that's one view. The other thing is the national, who's going to win the popular vote's the wrong question. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by, over 2 points right, in 2016. With what's happened since then, a Republican could lose the popular vote by 3, 4, maybe even 5 points, still win the Electoral College. So it is totally pointless to ask what the national popular vote's going to be.
Yeah.
The question that you want to ask is, in the swing states, who's going to do better or worse? And that's a case where Sanders picks up votes in the wrong places. He expands the Democratic margin in places like California and right, New York and liberal states. But he does worse in the states that are actually going to matter for the Electoral College. So I think the Sanders electability surge that we've seen is a complete myth and misreading of the polls.
I don't disagree with that. When I looked at the very liberal, which tend to be younger, people say they're very liberal and like they say they're likely to vote in the primary. If you ask the generic, would you vote for a Democrat or Donald Trump? It's just like Doug says, there's a huge number. There's 18% that say, oh, I wouldn't vote or depends. Among liberals, it's 80-20, but amazingly, among moderates and conservatives, likely to vote in the Democrat, only 66% think that the Democrat would win. And
there's about 15%
yeah, right,
that's
yeah,
on the fence, yep, that's movable one way or the other.
And there in the states, the moderates, the states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, there are many more moderate conservatives. It's not like Northern California where you got a whole bunch of very liberal people. I agree absolutely. You got to look at those key states.
Right.
When do you, by the way, start oversampling in those states?
Got a poll coming out
well, there you go,
tonight from Yahoo.
Yeah, well,
we'll have
go,
some more to say about that.
Yeah. Very good. So I would
tell us what it's going to say. No,
I would suggest that Donald Trump had a pretty good February up until this past week with coronavirus. But before then, he was acquitted on impeachment. The economy was chugging along, and he was very effectively showing up in primary state after primary state, bracketing the vote the next day. Just like a cat playing with the mouse, just toying around the Democratic candidates and just having a jolly old time. And you add that with the Democratic unrest over Bernie Sanders, he looked like he was in a pretty good position. I happen to be a very big believer in Schadenfreude in politics. I am never comfortable gloating about someone else's misery. I learned this personally when I worked on the Bush campaign in 1992, and we thought Bill Clinton, there's no way Bill Clinton was going to win the election, and we learned our lesson the hard way. I remember in 2016 vividly, Democrats doing what Republicans are doing now, just crowing about how Republicans are stuck with Donald Trump, and just very much the same argument, just The guy can't win. He's toxic. He's going to crush Republicans down ticket. The party's in disarray. And guess what? He won the election. You guys look at surveys. You look at Donald Trump's numbers. Let's set aside coronavirus. That's kind of a moving target for the time being. But what in Donald Trump's numbers suggest weakness at this point? I mean, there's obviously the nature of how he won. He won by 78,000 votes.
The biggest weakness is he's Donald Trump and he does what Donald Trump does.
Right.
So he had some bad weeks during the impeachment where there was more bad news coming out.
Right.
And then he had what was a good week, which is he was acquitted.
State of the Union.
In one week he was acquitted. He had the State of the Union, Iowa. That was a good week for Donald Trump.
Right.
Yeah.
Did it move the needle? Well, there was a Gallup poll that came out that showed Trump at his all-time high popularity,
49%.
Yeah. That was, well, first, Gallup's accuracy in recent elections is nothing to brag about.
Right.
But in particular, what we found is that Republicans had not been answering our polls the previous few weeks, and suddenly they came back after Trump was acquitted.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at our overall pattern. It's hard to show visuals on podcasts, but it's basically
I see a red line and two squiggly lines.
It's a flat line.
And they're both flat.
Yes.
People's opinion of Trump has not changed.
Just doesn't move.
Right. So we have him among registered voters at 44% approval, 53% disapproval, mm-hmm. which is basically where it's been for the last 2 years. So I don't really think he moved the needle on that. So his weakness is he's not terribly popular. His strength is you can't do anything to move that 44% approval.
Right.
You can have the worst bad news you can think of, and so far it hasn't moved the needle.
Yeah, the point is that's Donald, in the 2018 elections, the data showed that it was a referendum on Trump. But the point is that was anybody against Donald Trump. And now you can't beat somebody with nobody, and the question is, which one of those Democrats are you sure could win? And it's not clear to me that there's an easy answer to that.
Well, the Democrats in 2018 were able to run a campaign focused on health care and run moderate candidates in
places where you needed to run moderates.
Right.
Right. They won. They won in about 30 Trump districts in 2018.
So that was a great recipe for Democratic success. The lesson they learned is that they need a really progressive candidate to run on taking away your Obamacare.
And your personal health insurance.
And spending, an extra $35 or so trillion,
Well, it's a classic case of when the United States among democracies is unique in that we are the only system where there's and other systems have obviously competition between the parties, as in Britain and in Germany, but we're the only one that has competition within the party to see who nominates. And it seems to me from 2016 and 2020, that process has gotten out of hand. The parties do not have any control over how many people are running. And if you watch that Democratic debate Tuesday, it was just unbelievable.
Right. Let's talk about the parties for a second. Your father's Democratic Party would have sent Amy Klobuchar to the sidelines. They would have sidelined several of these Democrats who just aren't going to get to the
Buttigieg
finish line.
Buttigieg would be gone.
Buttigieg. They would have consolidated. They would have found one candidate.
Steyer's gone.
Would have had that many primaries, actually, by the way, too. But they essentially would have found one person to get behind them. But what we've seen now—
I would describe that as Dave Brady's Democratic
Dave Brady's
Party.
Yes. Wouldn't be a podcast.
Brady's father
wouldn't
have
be a podcast.
Been in the,
My father would have.
His father was
not
a Whig.
Been in the Democratic Party. He would have been left. No.
Okay, we got through the obligatory Brady age shot here. No, but there was a time in American politics where the parties would have just driven this process, and they would have essentially picked the nominee or driven that nominee in that direction. And we've seen now, for the second straight cycle, the party establishment has no control over this. An outsider comes in, somebody who's really not a member of the party.
Yeah, bill, that's not brand new.
It really seems to stand out right now.
Since the 1960s.
Since the
1960s, we've been in that system.
Yeah. Right. He runs a populist message. He runs against the establishment. Yeah. He runs against money. He runs against influence.
I think it's easier to do now. Well, maybe not. I think of the 72, 76 when Carter won the nominee, the governor from Georgia, no one thought he'd do it. He wins Iowa. and then he moves on to get the nomination. There were quite a few people in the field. I don't think there were 19 or 20, but...
Yeah, so I don't know. That's a good question. I think for 50, 60 years, there hasn't been a party establishment to actually regulate the process.
Right.
It usually has the effect of producing a nominee that's acceptable to all, and maybe we'll see that this year. I mean, if Biden wins in South Carolina and then recovers on Super Tuesday and becomes the consensus candidate, you would have the so-called party decides. It's for a long time been a wide open process.
Yeah, I agree with that. The only thing that strikes me as a little different is that there seems among the extremists in both parties, they're less willing to say, if I don't get the candidate I wanted, I'll vote for them. In the general, that's only, and I don't have any data. That's just I'm tossing it out. But McGovern is like the reason I hesitate there is because I think of George McGovern and a friend I had at Harvard who I was living in Texas at the time, and I told him McGovern's going to get killed. Yeah. The guy said, "What? I don't know anyone. I don't know anyone that's not going to vote for McGovern." So that's why I hesitate. And it may not be that different.
Well, and you had a. In 1968, when the primaries were much less important than they are now,
right.
Sides that were really at war with each other. There have been some changes. So
more primaries,
More primaries, rules that are more favorable to candidates getting smaller percentages of votes.
Mm-hmm. That happened after Jesse Jackson in 1988.
A bit of it happened after 2016.
Did it twice.
So these rules were, to some extent, optimized for Sanders, where you can have a situation where the candidate's getting 25-30% and getting majority of delegates, which is what everyone's worried about. The other thing was the front loading, in particular of California going next week. Our data shows that Sanders would win one-on-one against any Democratic candidate. So thinning of the field here, I don't think helps the moderates that much.
Right. I just wrote a piece for the Washington Post on California and March 3rd, and here's what interests me. California is a mixed primary. Independents can come vote in the Democratic primary. The Republican side is closed. And California divides its delegates a little complicated, more so than other states. 416 delegates are at play on Tuesday. 144 are decided by a statewide vote. But for Doug Rivers or Dave Brady to get any of those delegates, he has to get to 15% in the statewide vote. If you look at the Real Clear Politics average of California right now, Bernie is, I think, 30 or 32% statewide. Elizabeth Warren is at 15.3. Biden is at about 14.8. I think they're right on the cusp of 15. Buttigieg is down at 10. I could paint you a scenario where Bernie could shut out everybody on statewide delegates if these candidates don't get to 15. Then the rest of the delegates, the 272 remaining, are decided by congressional districts. And again, you have to get to 15% per district. When you have six Democrats competing for, let's say, 70% of the pie in California, it's going to be hard to get to 15% in districts. Bernie could walk away from California with 350 delegates, which is one-sixth of the way to 1991, but also produces one other thing, which is what I would call shock and awe. You have Democrats in a tizzy right now because he has a 20-delegate lead over Pete Buttigieg.
Right.
One of the jokes about February is all of 155 delegates are decided in these four states.
Right.
The last number I looked at is like 45 to 25, I think. So Democrats are freaking out over Bernie being 45 delegates, 20 ahead. What happens if we wake up on the morning of March the 4th and suddenly he's not ahead by 20, but he's ahead by several hundred delegates?
Yeah, so the demands of the Bernie supporters that, he has to be the nominee because he's the clear choice, even if he isn't at a majority. I also think the ability to get to a majority goes up way beyond what people are estimating. They're, as always, overestimating.
You think he could get it on the first ballot?
Absolutely. I don't think, people have woken up and said, wait a second, these candidates that are polling under 10% need to get out of the race. Mm-hmm. And none of them want to do it because they want to be the, you know, essentially the alternative to Bernie,
right,
the way, you know, Ted Cruz and John Kasich, yeah, and so forth wanted to be the alternative
Rubio,
to Trump.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing.
And with California moving early, it may be too late for that to happen.
Yeah, the 15% rule, as you just explained so well, it really, you can get more delegates out of that, and that's the reason I think Doug is on the right path to say it's, the odds are that it will not be a brokered convention, although I think they're probably a little higher than
normal.
No, they're
definitely higher than normal.
But I wouldn't, if I was betting, I would not bet any money.
Well, let's say he gets over 300 in California.
Yeah,
Texas has 228 delegates. He was there right after the Nevada vote, so he has that state pretty well organized, it looks like. What about North Carolina votes, Massachusetts votes? He could have a very big haul of delegates.
Right, and for him to be stopped, essentially a bunch of candidates need to get out.
Yep.
Right.
And
unlikely.
You know, no one's getting out before South Carolina this Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
There are 2 days to Super Tuesday, so
they're
very little advantage for someone to withdraw at that point.
And they're all on the ballot in California.
Right. And some candidates like Klobuchar, I believe Minnesota votes on March the 3rd, so she's going to want to try to win her state.
Half of the Massachusetts primary vote will have been cast.
Right.
Yeah.
By then.
And another rule catches up with Democrats, by the way, if it becomes a game of chasing Bernie Sanders, and that's the idea of proportional delegates. Let's say you narrow the field down to Sanders and Bloomberg and Joe Biden, let's say for the sake of argument, three of them competing. Well, you go to Florida on March the 17th. Well, it's not a winner-take-all primary, so maybe Sanders wins, or if he loses to Bloomberg or Biden by a couple points, they're just going to divide the delegates almost
like, proportionally. That's exactly what happened with Obama and Hillary in 2008. He got that lead, and he just kept...
Yeah, as it winnows down to a small number of candidates, Sanders is going to be getting, assuming he does okay on Super Tuesday or has a good win on Super Tuesday, he will get 40 to 55% of the delegates, 60% state by state. He'll lose some and he'll win some, but it's enough to just to go to a majority. Yeah. And that's what Trump did in 2016. Republican rules are a little more favorable to the top candidate because it's...
more winner-take-all.
Right. But I think people are underestimating the extent to which the Democratic rules at the moment are actually pretty favorable to the top candidate.
So let me ask both of you guys. So after Super Tuesday, it's now March 5th or 6th, whatever. How much more certain... will you feel about what the results are?
Oh, I think we're going to be a lot more certain at that point. If Sanders emerges from Super Tuesday with, a lead of, 300 delegates, 400 delegates, that kind of thing, the air of inevitability is going to be in place.
Mm-hmm.
It's only if it's very clear that, everyone except one other alternative needs to drop out.
Yeah, I agree with Doug. And also keep in mind, Dave, this is a party that has been preaching fairness for the last 4 years and preaching the mantra of selected, not elected, and so forth. So how would you go to Milwaukee and take away the nomination from the guy with the most votes and the most delegates, having just said that they stole the election in 2016?
I want to do two things. One, say that Bill Whalen and Hoover and the Center for the American West have a poll coming out on for Super Tuesday for California that Doug ran for him. Will be out shortly. So
it's in the field now. We're not quite done yet.
Keep your eye on that. And that's by the way, on that point Bill just made, when last year, in 2016, when there was that claim at the end that Donald Trump couldn't win, and there was a movement to say, we ought to get former vice presidential candidate, blanking the guy from Wisconsin. Paul Ryan to run as an alternative.
How fleeting is fame.
And it's true. But Paul Ryan was run as an alternative.
Right.
That was a motion being put out. We put that in a YouGov poll, and among Republicans, it was 82% said if you did that, there would be hell to pay. So I think the same. I agree with you. The same thing is going to happen. If Bernie's got a substantial lead, if they take it away from him at that point at the convention, however they do it, it's over.
Because one of the themes week in and week out when there's a vote is Bernie's people are convinced each week the party is some way trying to screw them. They're already complaining about the California ballot now, how it's hard for independents to get access to the governor ballot. Gentlemen, let's talk about something. Which has also played a role in this election, and that is money, M-O-N-E-Y, which is, as Doug mentioned, why you don't see the likes of Joe Biden advertising in California. One candidate has spent $500 million, like Dr. Evil here, $500 million advertising. You didn't think it was possible.
Why would he spend millions when he could spend billions?
My view is that's the Meg Whitman. It looks so far like the Meg Whitman of U.S. politics.
Right. It is Michael Bloomberg, who we're talking about. He has already spent more money on his campaign than Hillary spent in her entire presidential campaign in 2016. What has $500 million got Michael Bloomberg?
15% in the polls.
Mm-hmm. He's 11 in the last.
Yeah, well, it goes up.
Average, yeah.
Right.
But it's a big drop from the week before.
Right. So, there were a few intervening events.
Yes, I agree.
He got $500 million of unpaid, so-called earned negative media.
Right.
Absolutely.
Bloomberg's basic problem is he's the most unpopular candidate among Democrats of the ones running at the moment.
Why so?
He's a Republican. He's a moderate.
Was a Republican, too moderate for the Democratic base.
Did stop and frisk.
Everyone ganging up against him. He went from zero to the teens in terms of
He did pretty
vote
well.
Based on advertising.
A very smart orchestrated advertising campaign where he talks about gun control, he talks about climate change, a lot of video with him hugging Barack Obama. It's a smart approach to building his numbers.
A tough candidate for Trump to run against. But I don't think it's going to happen. We're going to see the limits of that spending. Is he willing to put another $500 million in the next 2 weeks? Because that's what he needs at this point.
It does make you wish for the days of the old Sheraton Blackstone Hotel in Chicago in 1920.
I think that was a smoke-filled room.
Yes, it was. You could smoke in the Sheraton Blackstone then. That was the reference to
Brady and Whalen would be there with their cigars.
We'd be there with cigars, and we'd be deciding rationally who got the nomination because the criteria was which one of these candidates can win, not which one do I agree with.
It is, but a $500 million raid on the presidency, did you ever think you'd see something like this?
Wonder what the proportion in California.
Well, you mentioned Meg Whitman in California.
I'm not sure that $500 million would save him at this point.
I think Meg spent 160 of her million of her own fortune to run in California.
So he spent $500 million. Then the U.S. is three times bigger than.
A generation ago.
Oh yeah, that's real money. That's so it's only twice. So it's by proportion to the U.S. Nothing. Get the money out there, Mike.
Right.
Yeah, but
he's got it.
It didn't work. Yes, he does.
I mean, at some point it becomes an issue how much he's spending. Certainly among Democrats, one of the big negatives against him is he's trying to buy the election.
I actually think it's a really terrible thing to have a candidate who came from not much and founded a successful business and became mayor of New York and did a really pretty good job. But what a terrible thing to have a guy like that run.
He would be a strong Democratic candidate.
That's why they're not going to nominate
him. But what you're seeing is, the problem with the primaries from a party perspective is that you've got a bunch of activists that want to believe that their candidate is somehow going to magically turn out, millions of new voters.
Right.
That is the biggest myth. It has been a myth on the left all along. Whenever you get the turnout figures below 98, the idea is all these voters that are sitting out there that haven't voted, there's 40% who don't vote. They're all lefties, and if you get just the right candidate, they'll all rush out to vote. The only trouble is people on the right thought the same thing. The Goldwater people thought that, and it's just not true. They're, the people who don't vote in elections are generally less well-informed, know less about government, care less about politics, and so on and so forth. It's a myth. You disagree?
No, I don't. The biggest bump in turnout was African-American turnout in 2008, which was about a 10-point or so increase.
For them?
Yes, which increased their share of the electorate by about 1%.
1%.
In the 2018 midterms, you did see a significant increase in younger voter turnout, but not nearly enough to overcome the problem that you would face, and frankly, it was in the wrong places for Democrats to win a presidential election.
Right. Now, South Carolina is going to be interesting in this respect because I believe 60% of the Democratic vote in South Carolina is African American, and Obama
61% was the exit poll percentage.
And I think Obama won 80% of it when he ran in 2008.
Right.
So I'll be curious to see what transferability does for Joe Biden. This has been an ongoing riddle for Democrats. Barack Obama has been involved in the last five elections, either on the ballot or trying to move votes in his direction. He runs in 2008, and turnout is handsomely wonderful for him. He encourages Democrats to save the House in 2010, and he's punished. He loses 63 seats. He runs in 2012. He's rewarded again in 2014. He goes out and he tries to save the Senate, punished again in 2016. He tries to get the Obama coalition to turn out for Hillary, and it doesn't quite work. So this is what I'm looking at in South Carolina moving beyond. Where are the Obama voters?
We have bad turnout, Miles.
Which kind of begs the question, where is Barack Obama?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, the question, who's going to turn out?
Well, he's sitting on the sidelines. I don't think if he intervened at this point and endorsed Joe Biden, it would be that effective.
I agree with that.
Coattails are one of those things much talked about, but really much in evidence.
It's a classic line that a German general said about the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1918, said, we're shackled to a corpse.
And Obama doesn't want to come out because if Biden doesn't get the nomination, then he's lost.
Well, it's just embarrassing as hell for a former president to be on the wrong side of things. By the way, Kirsten, California, Kamala Harris is yet to endorse a candidate. Gavin Newsom is yet to endorse a candidate.
Do you think that'll make a difference?
I think it makes a difference for them and their future.
Oh, their future, but not.
And I think they consider
it. Which is why they're waiting to see who's going to win.
But, right. So they're holding out in part for Biden. Harris, about a month ago, kind of indicated she was going to support Biden.
By the way, one of the questions I think you put on, Bill, for the California survey was if Gavin Newsom was running for president, would you vote for him?
Well, Newsom interests me in this regard. There is an obvious choice for him in this primary. That's Pete Buttigieg. Why? Gavin Newsom, as mayor of San Francisco, starts the ball rolling nationally on same-sex marriage. That's in 2004. Causes a lot of problems in the Democratic Party. Yeah. There are people working for John Kerry who blame Newsom to this day for costing them Ohio because Ohio had a ballot initiative, definition of marriage, and had a big turnout for that to help the Bush campaign. But Newsom starts his conversation in 2004 as a mayor. And here we are 16 years later, and there's now another former mayor like Newsom who is openly gay and married, and he's running for president. If you're Gavin Newsom, this is a perfect bookend message for you.
Well, except Buttigieg is too young. So if Newsom has ambitions, Buttigieg will always be younger than
But he's also at 10% in the polls. And one thing from a California standpoint about Buttigieg that I find interesting, Michael Douglas is doing fundraising letters for him. Kevin Costner is. Michael Douglas is with Bloomberg. Yeah. So is Clint Eastwood. Yeah. Apparently Bloomberg's not seen a movie in the 21st century. But Costner is out trying to raise money for Buttigieg. But Hollywood is kind of writ large, not that noisy about Mayor Pete. And I mention this because, number one, Mayor Pete is kind of like an Aaron Sorkin screenplay. And that here's a fellow who went to Harvard and served in the military and came back and turned his back on making big money and went back to the Midwest to – Right. You know, to show the masses we can do good government. That's Aaron Sorkin in a nutshell. It's a kind of a civil rights message. It's kind of a feel-good message. Electing an openly gay candidate in Hollywood is very involved here in California in 2008 with Proposition 8, which was a Definition of Marriage Act out here. But outside of Mr. Costner, not too many celebrities. I was talking to a friend about this today, and she said, it's not just so much a reflection of Buttigieg, it's kind of a reflection of politics in general. Politics are kind of viewed darkly in Hollywood right now. Some celebrities kind of feel burned by the Hillary experience in 2016. And to the extent that Democrats have juice in Hollywood, it's kind of the negative populist.
It's interesting in that because normally at this time of the year, you'd be asked to give all kinds of speeches to Stanford alumni about the election. And this year, there's nothing going on. And I talked to an unnamed source in the alumni office and asked about that. And they said, well, we're not getting as many requests as we used to. And when we get the requests, we're trying to kill them because they do not do us a lot of good when they have those contests because of the polarization. And so they're trying to have as few as possible, which is consistent with what you say about Hollywood.
Yeah, I thought after the 2018 midterm that we would see a surge of turnout. But wow, it seems like people are burnt out over this. It's just overload.
I think the reaction. I watched the debate a week ago with my daughters, who were very interested. And before it was 30 minutes old, they are gone. They just went somewhere else. They found the debate very distasteful. And there's an old book in political science by John Hibbing and Elizabeth that talks about Americans don't like politics when it's about yelling.
Yeah.
And one of the findings was the Supreme Court to this day has higher ratings than the Congress and the president. And the reason is because they don't. The fights aren't public. A bunch of Americans do not like the Tuesday night debate scene.
Yeah, and I mean, this happens every primary season because it's intramural, it'll be clear by the fall what the stakes are, but I expected a huge amount of enthusiasm at this stage among Democratic primary voters, and they're sort of getting kind of reasonable turnout numbers, but definitely not great numbers.
Yeah. One thing I did want to point out, I think Doug agrees, I think you do too, but if you don't, you'll say so. I think anybody who thinks that Bernie Sanders can't win is nuts.
Yep.
Anything can happen. We all sat around at this very same spot in 2016, 4 years ago, and you asked, who's going to win? And we, all of us, were wrong. And I think we don't know what's going to happen. There's plenty of stuff can happen. Right. And my view is anybody who really wants to make a claim Bernie can't win, wrong. He can.
Yeah, so I definitely think he can win. A bunch of his policies are actually pretty popular. Some of them not so much.
Yeah.
But he's a very high risk for the Democrats
to
nominate.
But that doesn't mean he can't win.
Right.
Right, but you start looking at forces beyond the president's control.
Coronavirus?
Well, coronavirus is a great example because
the economy.
Coronavirus is the economy. Look at what
it could be the New Orleans of this year.
It could be Katrina of this because coronavirus affects the economy. Coronavirus affects your stocks. And just
certainly has.
Go look up your stocks the last couple of days. ain't it fun to look it up?
I did. No.
And then on top of that, coronavirus.
Especially when you're emeritus.
Exactly. Exactly. I thought that was Latin for super wealthy. No. But also coronavirus is affecting people's lifestyles. Just talk to your friends who are thinking twice now about going to Europe in the summer or wanting to go see the Great Wall of China or something like that. People are now afraid to go on airplanes. That cast a certain pall over the election, and it gets to really Donald Trump's weak point, which is your confidence in Donald Trump being in charge.
I agree.
Yeah. Trump's strength is what? He's the president, and the economy is going along pretty well. So I have a niece who's a great example of this. She hates Donald Trump at the heat of a thousand suns. But we were talking about the other day, and she was in a five-minute rant about Donald Trump. And then she stopped, and she went, oh. And I said, what? She goes, I just took my IRA. It's up 15%.
Well, down 10% now.
Down 10% now. But the point is something like coronavirus could come in like Katrina and just become a metaphor of maybe a country that's not very lucky, your life not being very happy, and suddenly you don't trust the guy in the White House.
Yeah, and a normal president would have grabbed this thing and said it's the, you know, the biggest threat. It's a terrible problem, and would wait to claim credit till the thing disappeared, and provided some cover if it went south.
Exactly.
And you know, so that was just insane. Now, he's lucky, so maybe he'll be right, in which case won't be a problem for him at all.
Well, time will tell. Okay, so let's wind down the podcast here. Super Tuesday coming up. You're going to be in New York, Doug?
Indeed.
Crunching your numbers. What are you looking at on Tuesday?
How are you getting out there? Walking?
taking the train?
Getting on one of those germ-filled airliners.
You have 15 states and territories, but 14 states. Right. You have 1,300 delegates to look at. So where are you focusing?
So the exit polls have been quite good this year for the primary. And in the past, exit polls have not – they've had partisan bias in the general election, but have usually performed better in primaries. And this year, they've really been on the mark.
That, by the way, is because in the primary, you don't have partisan bias.
That's right. Right. But I'm just saying that in Iowa, the first exit poll data was, said it was a close race between Sanders and Buttigieg. Actually had Buttigieg slightly ahead, and then had Klobuchar third, which is the outcome. New Hampshire, it had Sanders with a decent lead, showed a surge for Klobuchar and Buttigieg, about right, and showed Biden getting creamed. So all that was on. And then the Nevada poll, it was also reasonably good. So I think we'll know what the night's going to look like early from the exit poll.
The bad news is California and Texas.
California is going to take forever to count, and so
Texas, not so long.
No, Texas I think will count pretty fast.
Yeah. Texas is faster than California, so California.
California has this problem of absentee voting.
Yeah. People vote at the last minute, and the rules are if you mail in your absentee ballot on the day of the election, as long as it shows up a couple days after the election, it gets counted, and it takes the state a month to certify the vote.
Right.
It's not going to move. It's not going to move delegates that much, but
it will increase uncertainty. And if California is great for Sanders, it's going to be less clear that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
The other states have less absentee voting, and they have rules that the absentee vote has to be counted in advance. The other little technical point for polling nerds is that absentee vote is measured by a pre-election telephone poll that's pretty small and not that reliable. Yeah. So the exit poll will have a lot less of on-the-day vote being counted as a fraction of the total vote. So you're going to see, I think, the networks being pretty conservative in calling the results.
Okay. Final question, gentlemen. Of all the candidates on that stage in South Carolina the other day, if we get together a month from now, March the 27th, and have a conversation about this race, how many of those Democrats are still in the race, do you think?
I think Biden's still in because I think he's going to win South Carolina. Bloomberg's still in because he got a lot of money. I think Steyer, Klobuchar, and Buttigieg will be gone or should be gone.
I have no idea. I think Steyer will triangle after Super Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. You think he'll keep going?
No, I don't think he'll keep going.
Yeah.
I think it'll be the end of the line for Klobuchar. I think she probably should have given up after Nevada. The rest, I don't have a clue. You know, will Bloomberg want to continue spending hundreds of millions and getting nothing other than embarrassment for it? I don't know. Will Elizabeth Warren, who said she's in it for the long haul, and I think she means it, will she drop out even though...
No.
Which her finances could not be good at this point.
That doesn't mean she
right,
has
but
to drop
she can
out.
Run a cheap campaign.
Okay.
Certainly through March, which is all that's really going to count. If you look at the calendar, it's pretty thin after March.
It is thin. So Ohio votes, Florida votes, Arizona votes, Illinois votes. It's, I think, after March 27th, this race is pretty much settled by March 27th,
65% of the delegates will have been chosen.
I think Georgia votes in first week of April. So.
Yeah.
Wisconsin, and then Tuesday, April 28th, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island, and Alaska, Hawaii, Louisiana, Wyoming. So those are the states that are left.
Yeah, but you tend to get a bunch of states with not a ton of delegates.
Right.
So they're going to be watched, but we're going to know, essentially, is one candidate in a position to essentially, by doing reasonably well in the remaining primaries, get to a majority, or is the math impossible for them?
I guess the one thing that makes me a little less certain is nine of these states on Super Tuesday are either southern states or, like Utah, conservative. And so I wonder, and it's a question of turnout. I mean, Texas has a lot of people who are liberal. But the question is, will they turn out? Will Biden do well? I can imagine a scenario which Biden does pretty well on Super Tuesday because he's more moderate than Bernie, and he picks up a lot of the black vote. So
yeah, the mistake is to believe that a moderate state has lots of moderate Democrats.
Primary
in
voters,
the
yeah.
primary.
Right.
You know, primary turnout is a
yep.
fraction of the total. You've got, you know, in a state like South Carolina, which has no chance of voting Democratic in the fall,
right.
You've got a 60% black electorate.
Right. So, but remember, the Democratic leadership, DLC's Clinton strategy was, when they lost all those elections, was you have those first four primaries, Iowa, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. historically, South Carolina for the Democrats because it's black, Republicans it's okay, because and Nevada because it's mixed. And the idea was at the end of that, you then are down to two or three candidates. You go to Super Tuesday, which was Southern
dominant.
You're
saying someone designed this system?
Yes, yes. Southern, not anymore.
No.
But at the time, it was designed like that. Super Tuesday, they emphasized Super Tuesday because Southern voters, Democratic voters in the primary were more like the November voter than they were in California and New York. But that's gone because now, it's gone because California and everybody's moved up.
Not always a perfect system. It did get you Michael Dukakis in 1988. Mm-hmm. So not what you designed.
Well,
but,
that was
also worth noting.
It got him Bill Clinton in 92 and 96.
Yeah, of course, who did Bill Clinton run against in 1992 in the primaries?
A whole bunch of people. Former governor of New Hampshire.
He ran against a very ailing Paul Tsongas.
Yeah.
And he was lying about his health.
His
principal opponent was Jerry Brown.
Jerry Brown.
Jerry
he
Brown.
Came in late.
A very populist single-payer healthcare Jerry Brown.
Yes.
Very Bernie-like Jerry Brown.
We
the people Jerry Brown.
I agree. But the point is that Super Tuesday was set up for that purpose, and it no longer works.
Yeah, and it's no longer a Southern primary.
Well, where it gets
the Democratic Party in 92 is different from the Democratic Party.
So where it gets confused is when you do Super Tuesday and you say, okay, it should be kind of appealing to one demographic, then you throw California into it, then you throw Massachusetts Minnesota, and now you have both a national race and it allows candidates to get out of a region and really just kind of cherry pick where they want to go. I think Klobuchar, where did she go after Nevada? She went to Arkansas, just trying to find any state where she could finish second.
Minnesota.
Yeah, try to win Minnesota, go home. All right, John, it sounds like we agree that on the morning of March the 4th, we're all going to have to whip out our calculators and figure out if Bernie can get to 1991 and first ballot victory.
I'll wait for Doug to do that, and he can tell me. And then if I want to disagree, I can. But let him count. He's a better calculator.
See you in a month, Bill.
Yeah.
Okay, see you guys in a month. Gentlemen, thanks for the podcast. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this podcast, those Democrats looking to face Mr. Trump in November. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. Tell your friends all about us. I almost said don't tell your friends about us. Please tell your friends all about us. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows, including Dave Brady and Doug Rivers, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover INST. Dave Brady is not on social media, but Doug Rivers is. His Twitter handle is at Doug _ Rivers. That's at Doug _ Rivers. Rivers spelled as you might expect. And YouGov, the very fine company that he polls for, is Twitter handle is at YouGov. That's YOUGOV. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.